Great to have you along today on Labor Day on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And joining me are our regular holiday bird-watching guests, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
And Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, great to have you along, too.
Just like Bill, I'm always great to be with you or Larry or whoever is hosting the show.
Well, and it's just hard to believe that it's been 2 months already since we talked with you on July 4th. And I'm sure there's a lot of bird news to talk about that's happened in those last 2 months. But I want to make sure people know how they can join in, too. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. We're going to be talking a lot about migration. Are you noticing the start of some flocking as a precursor to that migration? Which birds are you noticing doing that? Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. So, Noel and Bill, there are birds that have just or that have finished their summer nesting and are now starting to form flocks. What might we be seeing actively doing that right now?
Well, at this time of year, we've got, as you mentioned, both the local birds are flocking up. So where during summertime we had the scattered families of birds, now that the nesting is long done, they're starting to join up in these large flocks. Some of them may be yet weeks, if not even a few months away before they even depart. And so we'll see this grouping of the birds. Others are on their way out right now, and in fact last night with this cold wind, air that came rushing in, and a shift to the north winds, an incredible migration last night.
Wow. And so what types of birds might we be seeing flocking right now, Noel?
Well, as Bill mentioned, they're kind of group specific. We've been seeing swallows gather on the telephone electric lines for the last few weeks and gathering together in flocks in preparation for migration. And, you know, these are starting to move south. As Bill mentioned last night, you could go outside after dark and just hear a lot of chip notes of migrants flying over. These are mostly songbirds, the passerines. So you're talking about everything from warblers and vireos to flycatchers or, you know, whatever it may be. And if you looked at the radar last night, someone sent out a Milwaukee radar shot around 3 a.m., and there's just quite a migration going on southbound. You can see birds all the way out to the border between Iowa and Wisconsin. You could see birds over Lake Michigan. So there was just a major movement with that wind shift yesterday.
Wow. So how does flocking benefit birds?
Well, what you're seeing is really they're joining for the resources. So as I mentioned earlier, when birds are nesting, you've got these individual families scattered all across the land, and they're basically just within that territory finding the food that they need for themselves and their young. Now that they're no longer tied to the nest sites, these birds are grouping together and are moving around to where that food is available. So large flocks of grackles are starting to form. Noel mentioned the swallows. It is both that some of these birds will move in these flocks, so as they're preparing for migration, they're both joining with others of their own kind to feed, hang around with them, and depart together. And others are also moving where they can exploit a lot of food. One thing I noticed very evidently here at Horicon Marsh was for the last 2 weeks or so, the great egret population has just been gathering up on the north end. Water levels are being drawn down on one of the impoundments that's concentrating the fish and making the feeding easier. So these birds are coming here to fatten up in preparation migration. And up until the end of this past week, 250 to 300 great egrets were gathered along the north end. It was just an incredible concentration of birds. I drove by there just about 45 minutes ago. You're lucky to find 50 of them. They packed up last night and they all headed out.
Wow. I don't know that this would qualify as flocking, but I was really surprised when I looked out into my yard yesterday. And generally, we get a lot of goldfinches, and often I'll see couples, a male and a female, around, especially around the Rudbeckia and the coneflowers, and, you know, pecking at the little seed heads. I looked out yesterday, and without even having to turn my head, I could see 6 males and a handful of females, too. And it was interesting because they were obviously all very focused. They were attacking the seed heads very vigorously. And every once in a while, a couple males would, you know, kind of make little threatening motions towards each other, but then they'd get right back to eating. So it was like they felt like they had to be slightly territorial, but they knew that they all needed to be there at the same time, too.
Yeah, the goldfinches are a late nesting species. And with all the juveniles out there now, along with the adult male and females, they're just so spectacularly, like you say, attacking, especially the composites for their seeds. And they're so noisy as they fly around, so they're just very conspicuous on the landscape. And talking about flocks, you know, all these flocks are gathering together in the morning after they've migrated all night. So it's a mixed species flocking, and it's a very loose flock with members coming and going all the time. But that's why some people are finding, 12 or 15 species of warbler in a natural area, or maybe even in their backyard if they're really out there watching. It's kind of tough this time of year because not all they give a little chip notes. They don't give a typical song, and with all the leaves out, they're still pretty hard to spot. So and plus you have all the juveniles and different plumages. So birding this time of year for things like warblers is quite difficult.
Well, we have several people who want to join in the conversation, so let's go to the phones now. Sunny in Oconomowoc is first. Hi, Sunny.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm wondering how long it takes hummingbirds to migrate out of the southern Wisconsin area. I had some hummingbird feeders out there, and they got emptied, and then I didn't see hummingbirds for quite some time. And now in the last 2 weeks, I've seen hummingbirds coming back to where I used to hang my hummingbird feeder.
Making you feel guilty.
A lot of times.
Yes. Well, I hung another feeder out now, and I haven't seen any hummingbirds.
A lot of times the local birds will move out, and you might have kind of an absence for a short time. And we see that with a number of species there. For a while, we weren't seeing robins. Now the robins are starting to move from more northern climes. So we'll continue to see hummingbirds throughout September. Gradually, the numbers will decline. And this is the time of year we try to encourage people to leave the feeders out for a while. But if you go, as we get into September, and if you go a couple of weeks without seeing any hummingbirds, you can probably take them down. Leaving them out certainly doesn't encourage them to stay longer than they want to be. And this is a time of year we have some rarities, some of the western species that are pretty much regular now through Wisconsin, even though they're really rare, may show up at a feeder. And, for example, rufous hummingbirds often show up later in the fall. And it's good to really take a good look at those and make sure that you have ruby throats and not one of these other rare western species of hummingbird coming through.
Thanks for that call, Sunny. And we'll definitely talk about what some recent rare sightings have been, but I want to make sure we get to Kim in Oconomowoc. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I'm wondering, we spent a lot of time out on the lakes around Oconomowoc. Lauren Mob and then the Rock River were into bull fishing for carp. So what we saw, and it's been three times now, on one bend of the Rock River just west of Oconomowoc, was what I and a couple other canoers that we passed are saying is a golden eagle. It's way bigger, and it does not have the white head, and I understand the young of the regular eagles don't have the white head, but the wingspan on this is almost over 7 feet, and I know we took in, like, the compensation for the narrowing of the river and the length of the wings, but it's huge. Have you gotten any reports about this?
Well, bald eagle and golden eagle are really about the same size. I think oftentimes darker birds may look a little bit larger to people, and there's also variation even among individuals. So if we were to take close measurements, yeah, there's variation within any one of the species of birds. The bald eagle, it'll go through a couple of different years of plumages, so we can sometimes distinguish, especially in flight, that first, second, third year. It isn't until 4 or 5 years old they attain the white head. There are a lot of reports of golden eagles that are most likely immature bald eagles. We have had some fair numbers of sightings of golden eagles in Wisconsin, and it turns out that the western part of the state, over toward the Mississippi River, seems to be kind of an important wintering site. And the more that people have started to look for golden eagles, the more we're actually finding. But they tend to come down fairly late in the season and spend the winter there. Doesn't mean that anywhere throughout the state you can't find a golden eagle at times, but with the large numbers of bald eagles, and we have over 1,500 nesting pair in our state, there's an awful lot of young floating around there. So it can be a little tricky to distinguish the two. Check your field guide and take a close look at those birds in flight.
Yeah, a bald eagle has proportionally a larger head and a shorter tail than a golden eagle. And as Bill mentioned, the wingspan is pretty darn similar. Females are larger than the males, so I'm guessing you might be seeing a female immature bald.
And also, Kim, if you're able to get a picture of that eagle and want to put it up on our Facebook page one of these days, we can certainly ask Bill and Noel to take a look at that. Certainly, the closer up you can get, the better. but that it sounds like an exciting sighting regardless. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Mary in Whitewater. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have some questions about house wrens. I understand they're not a native bird. Is that correct?
No.
No, they are.
Yep.
They are native?
Oh, yeah. In fact, a tropical migrant, too.
Oh, okay. Well, good. And I had a nesting house for them under a large shade tree in my backyard. And here in Whitewater, back in the spring, we had a 60-mile-an-hour windstorm. It knocked their house down. There was a pair. And I quickly went out and retrieved it. And there were three little babies in it that had died. They were just brand new, the size of my thumb. They had died. The nest fell apart. I put it all back together, and I rebuilt the house so it wouldn't fall anymore because it had deteriorated. I had someone help me rebuild it, put it back up, and the two parents were back in there, and they had another nest. Now, since then, I have watched them. I go out every night on my back porch while I eat, and I watch them go in and out and make noises, noisy little birds. And then in August, around the beginning of August, their song changed, and they got quieter. And around mid-August, they disappeared. And this happens every summer. All of a sudden, I don't hear house wrens anymore. And I assumed, you know, that their babies had fledged, although I never see wrens leave the nest. And I was wondering where the pair went. Did they start their migration in mid-August, and what happened to the babies?
Well, as you mentioned, the song or call, the vocalization changes. Once they're tending to the young, they want to be a little more secretive around the nest. And as the young first come out of the nest, there's usually a 2 to 3 week period where the young are still dependent on the adults. They'll be begging, the adults will be bringing them food until they're much more independent. And, of course, at that point, they know they're vulnerable, and so they tend to be quite quiet and quite secretive. So once they jump the box, they may move to the nearest bushes and trees and just find good shelter. You'll hear a little bit of that peeping, begging call. And otherwise, they try to be secretive because they are obviously vulnerable in the nest to the losses, just whether it's storm or a raccoon or some other predator. And once they're lucky enough to pull off a family, they certainly want to try to take care of them as best they can. As these birds, as Noel mentioned earlier, as they are now secretive, both in their movements among the dense foliage and they're not calling so much, it's really hard to detect the presence of some of these birds. If you can't see them, you can't hear them. We don't know if they're there or not. And as far as their departure goes, this is about the time of year that wrens start to pick up and move with other songbirds. And unlike springtime, where it's really obvious when the first of a certain kind of bird shows up, I mean, everybody knows when the first hummingbird and oriole all of a sudden is there after months. It's really hard to know when the last one leaves in fall. They just sort of disappear, and it's after a while you realize, we just haven't seen them anymore. So, yeah, they can be quite secretive and quite well hidden and then just pack up and go on a good cold front, and then that's it for the season.
You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry and talking with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright about birds. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. It's birds and bird watching today on The Larry Mueller Show. Hi, Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry and talking with Bill Volkert, who is a wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And, of course, talking with you, too, when you give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. On another warbler topic, we were talking about different warblers earlier, but how is the nesting season for the Kirtland's warbler this year, and why do we monitor them so closely, Bill?
Well, Kirtland's warbler is federally endangered. It's a relatively small population and very specialized. They winter in the Bahamas. They nest in the northern part of lower Michigan, and they tend to have a very specific requirements of 5 to 15 or maybe 20-year-old jack pine forests.
Hmm.
So intensive management really required the habitat management to keep the population there, and also control of cowbirds that had moved in and parasitized the nests. In other words, dumping their eggs in the Kirtland warbler nest. They have been so successful in bringing back the Kirtland's warbler, they're spilling over into Wisconsin. And in the past 3-4 years, they started showing up, and we got a good hint of actual nesting going on. And as a federally endangered species, there are really a couple of requirements once you officially list them. One is to come up with a recovery plan. How do we get them off the endangered list? And the other one is monitoring. You've got to know how many you've got, just how critically endangered they are, and if you're trying things to manage for them, are they responding, are they increasing, and at what point do we now have enough, they're no longer an endangered species, and we can basically move on from there. So once they showed up in Wisconsin, and again, as that federally endangered status, we were obligated to have to monitor the population. And so Fish and Wildlife Service has one person in particular assigned to this. Some summer interns have been hired, and some volunteer work has gone on, and we're keeping track of those birds to band, monitor them, try to identify how many pairs we have, how many young they're raising, and we're also finding that some of these birds we marked in the past year or two are coming back.
You know, what's amazing is that that Adams County is really the strong spot, even though they've been seen in a few other northern counties. This year, they actually documented 20 male and 11 females in Adams County. And they're getting, as Bill mentioned, a lot of banding is going on of these birds. And similar to last year, we had a high return rate with 16 of the 18 color-banded males. So you don't have to really re-catch these birds. You can just read the sequence of color plastic bands that they have on their legs to identify which bird it is. And they had 16 of the 18 color-banded males returning in 2011 that were there in 2010. And, of course, these birds are overwintering in the Bahamas. A lot of the work has been done on Eleuthera Island. And, of course, with all the weather and so forth that comes up the East Coast, you always wonder if some of these birds are going to get caught in nasty weather during migration. Mm. But it's amazing how successful and how much they return back between the wintering spots and the breeding spots, whether it's the northern lower peninsula or now here in Wisconsin.
I wanted to mention that Facebook user Gerald posted some great photos on the Facebook page for everyone to look at, hummingbirds and house wrens. So thanks for putting those up, Gerald. And I also wanted to zero in on something that you said, Bill, about Kirtland's warblers. One of the risk factors for them is cowbirds using their nests. Mm-hmm. Are cowbirds the only parasitic bird we have in Wisconsin?
Yes.
And can you explain a little more for people? I always think it's really interesting.
We refer to it as parasitic nester. And a parasite, of course, is an animal that makes us living off of someone else. So we think of, either external or internal parasites like ticks or tapeworms or something like that. But what we have is a bird that is relying on other species of birds to raise its young. So they don't build their own nest. They don't tend their own young. There are other birds in other parts of the world. So in Europe and Asia, the cuckoos have that same type of habit. And so these birds will slip in. Song sparrows, yellow warblers are some of the more common ones. But they've documented almost 100 different species of birds that they have actually parasitized their nests. And so when we have a bird like Kirtland's warbler that's critically endangered, we have limited habitat and other problems. The fact that these few birds are now raising not their own kind, but perhaps cowbirds, just adds to the problem. And so there has been a very focused program to try to remove the cowbirds from those nesting sites, just to give the Kirtland's warbler a little bit of an edge.
I saw what looked like a juvenile cowbird perched in my yard the other day, and my first thought was, oh, I wonder who raised him.
You never know.
I was feeling sorry for some poor tricked parents who had raised this cowbird. And often, the cowbird is much bigger than the species that's raising them, right?
Oh, yeah. And they will, first of all, they will oftentimes hatch either at the same time or a little earlier than the nest mates, and growing quicker compared to, say, a little warbler or a sparrow. They'll get all the food, and they'll basically starve out the others. Now, keep in mind that, this has been going on for eons out in nature, and a cowbird just found a unique niche, and other birds learn to tolerate it. But as we get pressures on these populations, and as populations go down, it certainly exacerbates the problem. Mm-hmm. And for something like Kirtland's warbler, the cowbirds were getting to be a serious problem. They weren't raising enough for their own young.
Yeah, it's kind of fun working with cowbirds during the Breeding Bird Atlas, because You really have to study the host to be able to confirm their breeding. So you're looking for nests with a cowbird egg in it, or, as Bill mentioned, a chipping sparrow or a song sparrow or a warbler species feeding a young cowbird to be able to confirm cowbirds. And, you know, they'll sit and perch and just watch other birds to try to locate nests. Sometimes they'll walk around on the ground hoping to find a nest, and they actually will fly into a tree and be very noisy, flapping their wings a lot, again, hoping to be able to flush a bird, a potential host bird, off their nest so they can go in and lay eggs. So cowbirds are really interesting behavior, and because we have so much more fragmented habitat and have done so much clearing here in Wisconsin and eastern states, cowbirds are much more prevalent as a parasite species than they were back in, say, pre-settlement time.
Hmm. Always interesting to talk about the cowbirds. Let's go back to the phone. We have Chris in Hooksville. Hi, Chris.
Well, good morning. Thanks for the great program.
Sure.
We live in the rural megapolis of Cooksville, and we used to have whippoorwills that when nighthawks would come flying through in droves, this is the period we'd typically seen them. My wife saw as many as 5 last week, and I just wonder where they may have been gone. Where have they moved to?
Yeah, you bring up two really interesting species that are related to each other. They're both members of the goatsucker family. And nighthawks first, because they are, as you mentioned, this is a time that we're seeing them move. And we've had a few sightings in the last week of several hundred birds at one location. There was a fellow in Manitowoc County, I don't know if it was yesterday or day before, he counted to 600. And we've had other sightings of 300 and 400 at a time. And I think the all-time large count was by the late Bill Cowart down in Milwaukee County, where he had, or maybe the southern Ozaukee County, where he had between 10 and 15,000 at one time, just a swarm of nighthawks. This is a species that's declining in Wisconsin. In fact, I'll be coordinating a project this summer called Project Nighthawk, where we're trying to get a better feeling for what some of the small towns nighthawks are still nesting in. They build typically on the ground, but they also use gravel roofs in small villages and even in cities. So it's an interesting species, declining, as are whippoorwills. You don't see whippoorwills during migration, but they're certainly quite the songsters once they reach their breeding grounds. And they are also declining. Both of these species migrate all the way to the tropics for the wintertime. And we're trying to better understand what's happening with their whippoorwills, and that's why a couple of years ago we have a so-called nightjar survey, where people go out and run the same routes, survey 10 stops along an established route, trying to set a baseline on what kind of whippoorwill numbers we still have in Wisconsin. But as a species, both these species, we're quite concerned about the decline that we're seeing in their populations.
Oh, it sounds like Cooksville is a small town to put on your list.
Right.
Make a note of that. All right. We had Susan in Milwaukee who couldn't stay on the line but wondered if she should leave her finch feeders out all winter or if this could delay migration.
Finch or hummingbird?
Finch feeders.
Well, we have finches around the entire year. So, some of these birds that do visit feeders this time of year or on migration, but any kind of feeders that you put out, the thoughts are today is that they do not really delay or prevent any kind of normal movements, whether it's migration or even local movements of birds. So you can leave them, finch feeders, obviously, 365 days a year. Hummingbird, obviously, once this fall you haven't seen a hummingbird for a couple weeks, you can go ahead and take that in.
I remember when we were talking on July 4th, I believe it was, people were concerned that if they were going on vacation and their feeders were going to run out during the summer, that was bad for the birds. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you guys said that in the summer, putting out bird feeders is much more about us than it is about them, because it's a nice way for us to be able to draw them and see them. But that changes once the weather changes too, doesn't it?
Well, in wintertime, we still find the vast majority of the food that birds gather tends to come from the natural sources. So I guess overall, most of our bird feeding benefits us more than the birds. But because of the occasional severe weather in winter, if we get freezing rain, deep snow, high winds, things that make food gathering a little difficult for birds, it's a quick, easy stop, and we may be able to actually help some birds to get over the hump. But for the most part, We even find that at least one study I know of where they looked at winter habits of birds, even then, with all the feeders out there, something like 80% of their food was still gathered in the wild. It's quick, it's easy, it's convenient. And as I say, in wintertime where we can get occasional severe weather, it may help get them over the hump. And one other comment as far as migration goes, it's not the shortages of food that drive migration. So leave your feeders out for hummingbirds and others, as we mentioned before, but it's actually the shortening of the day length. Besides, if birds waited until the food ran out to migrate, it's a little late. They usually go before mm-hmm. that.
One of the challenges I think we're going to see, and I could see it the last two winters on doing Christmas bird counts, is because of the high price of bird seed and with the economy, I think we're seeing fewer people stocking up their feeders routinely. And from what I understand, prices of black oil sunflower, which is the most common seed that people purchase to put in feeders, is quite high right now. And apparently so much of the sunflower crop is going for sunflower oil that we might even see higher prices this fall. And I've had one seed dealer says he's not even sure what kind of quantity of seed he can buy this wholesale for this fall winter period. So it's going to be something that people that like to buy seed for birds, it's going to be interesting to keep mm-hmm. an eye on what the price is this year.
That's one of the reasons I grow so many purple coneflowers, is that I just leave the seed heads up all winter, and their little feeders all over the yard. All right, let's go to Susan in Green Bay next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Just to dovetail briefly, we've been putting out safflower seeds just basically to keep the squirrels away, and it's a little more cost effective, and quite a few birds like it. But anyway, that wasn't my question. We have we live in a wooded subdivision and have lots of woodpeckers, and I've got a suet feeder out to attract them. And this last summer, we were fortunate enough to have a, now help me with this, either pileated or pileated.
Yes.
Woodpecker.
Yes. I come from Southern Ohio, and I learned it as a pileated, but most people here in Wisconsin seem to call it pileated.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, nesting, for the first time nearby, and it was coming around to the suet feeder, and then really, thankfully, was bringing its offspring over also to share, and teach it how to use the suet feeder or whatever. Just wondering, is this bird likely to nest in the same location next year again? This is the first year we've seen it. And will the offspring likely keep coming around?
Well, these birds, once they set up a successful territory and if they find enough food in the area, and especially for a lot of birds, if they were successful in raising young in one year, why not try it again? The pileated woodpecker is certainly dependent on very large forests with relatively large trees. So you have to have a fairly good size forest to stand for them to find enough food for them and their young. But, there again, if you've got good habitat and you've got a pair that moved in and even raised their young, I'm sure they would try it again. One of the problems, of course, is the available not just food from large trees that are out there, the dying trees, but also nest sites. They need a pretty good sized tree. And, of course, it's a dead tree, which only stands about so long, so they get a couple of years of good use and have to find another one. But, I would expect they would stick around. You asked about bringing their young back. Well, those young will disperse. They'll move on to find their own territory. And, again, they'll have to spread out a little bit. So as they mature, they'll try their own luck and raise their own family.
Just hopefully like our children.
Yeah. All right. Not too close, but not too far, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Pat in East Troy now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Yeah, happy Labor Day.
You too.
Thank you. I just thought of something else that might connect up with my first comments. Early in in June sometime, a robin built a nest on top of a light that is attached to the side of my house, and I didn't realize it, and I turned on that light, and the next day the robin had left, and the babies that had just been hatched were no longer alive. And I want to make a warning to myself and anybody who has a similar experience. Try to keep your lights off until they get a chance to get out of the nest. Hard lesson to learn. In addition to that, a little later in the season, the robins came to my jelly feeder and enjoyed it just as much as the orioles did, who were flocking. I had probably at least a dozen orioles at one time.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, it was fun for while it lasted. Let's see, what was the last thing I was going to tell you? I can't remember.
I think you had some baby cardinals?
Oh, yes. Just last week, there were some very well-filled-out, puffy cardinal youngsters fluttering around on the ground, although they could fly, asking their mother to stuff food down their gullets. And a week ago, I heard Cardinal giving his whistle, and I wondered if that was an indication that the babies had hatched or that he was looking for another family to start. I don't know how to interpret the call.
I think he was just feeling good. You know, occasionally a bird, I was out about 6 hours yesterday in the field, and, you know, occasionally you do hear, you know, mourning doves cooing, or you'd hear a song sparrow, or you'd actually heard a cardinal yesterday, but it's very sporadic, and I don't think it really means anything from a territory or nesting standpoint. One thing I think we have noticed this year is a number of species fledging young pretty late in the year. I mean, I've still seen turkeys in the last week that are unable to fly yet. So you have birds that I think because of the cool spring, they may have delayed everything, or they may have been unsuccessful, and they may be re-nesting or a second nesting attempt. So I think we're seeing a number of species that have young still here in late August, early September.
I want to draw people's attention to a great picture of sandhill cranes that Michael posted on the Facebook page, and he also had a question. He says, I took this picture this morning, and I'm wondering, when do sandhill cranes begin migrating? At some point, are the cranes I see in Madison birds from farther north passing through on their way south?
Well, unless we have marked birds, it's hard to know who's who out there. Basically, almost all the cranes look alike. So that's why we do the bird banding. Without actually tagging or marking individuals somehow that we can distinguish one individual from the rest of them, it's hard to know what's happening with that turnover in the population. But as far as their migration, we will see them now really gathering up in these flocks. And we'll start to see maybe the end of this month, certainly October, we might see some departure. Usually about mid-late October, I see some flocks overhead. And then well into Thanksgiving, we'll see cranes sticking around fairly late. They don't tend to just pick up like geese and fly. You'll actually see them gather up on a good updraft. They'll circle and they'll soar. And I've watched these birds go up thousands of feet. And all of a sudden, when they get up high enough, they'll flank out like a big V. And from there, they'll take off on those winds. So it's really great to watch the day that they're leaving.
One of my goals is to go see the Platte River staging. When is a good time to do that?
The Festival of Cranes is in the third week of March, and those are the lesser sandhills. They're a little smaller than the ones we get here in Wisconsin, but far more numerous.
All right. I will mark my calendar.
Yeah, you can go to, I think, www.nebraskatravels.com and then put a slash in there and put sandhill crane migration. They actually have a website because it is so important, as with many of our birds. They're certainly a boon to the economy and local communities, mm-hmm. and so forth are taking advantage. And that's why places like Horicon have bird festivals to try to show off and bring people in that spend money looking at birds. And certainly the Platte River is a well-known place where hundreds and thousands of people go annually to watch cranes.
Staying on the crane subject for a moment, Doug and Deb emailed, could you talk about the distribution of whooping cranes in Wisconsin? There was a pair in southern Polk County for a couple of weeks in June. I've never seen them before in 25 years of living here.
Well, the whooping crane is another federally endangered species. And back in the 1940s, we were down to like 15 individuals in the entire world. There's been a tremendous effort to build it back up. The entire free-flying population goes from Aransas, Texas, that's their wintering site, up into Wood Buffalo National Park, which is Canada, right on the border of the Northwest Territories in West Central Canada. The big fear is you've got all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. All of the world population of whooping crane is in one flock, and there have been a number of efforts to try to not only help that population, but to start a second one. We tried very early on what they called cross-fostering, to take whooping crane eggs, put them under sandhill cranes. That was done out in Idaho area. That didn't work out. We didn't understand cranes. They are quite different from other birds. We have a non-migratory population in the Kissimmee River area in Florida. They've basically hit kind of a ceiling. They've grown, but the population sort of leveled off. And now Wisconsin has been the site for at least the last 10 years to hand-rear these birds and to teach them a new migratory route from Wisconsin down to Florida. It's a fairly successful project, but it turns out that as these birds have been maturing, they've not been rearing young on their own at anywhere near the rate that was hoped for, and so they relocated the program from Nisida National Wildlife Refuge into Green Lake County area. And we're also looking at some releases of whooping cranes at Horicon Marsh this fall. Maybe, I guess, we could look at a few false starts. They didn't pan out the way we want, but that's also what happens in these sort of recovery programs, that we really don't understand a lot of these birds, and what we know about one species may not be applicable to the next, and it's a little bit trial and error. But we have at least been able to successfully rear the birds, teach them a new migratory route. Now the next step is hopefully have them start nesting on their own as they mature and building that population up in sort of a natural fashion. But it'll take a long time. It's a tremendous effort.
Great. Thanks for that question. Let's go to Susan in Bristol next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for this program. This is very, very nice.
Sure.
I have a quick comment because you brought up the subject of cranes, and then I have an identification question. A couple of years ago, I was outside in the morning doing some gardening, and there was a sandhill crane perched atop my garage, a big guy.
Wow.
I don't know if it was male or female, but it's sitting right on top of my garage, and my cat was sunning himself on my my picnic table, and I walked up closer to get a better look at the crane, and he took off and flew right over the cat, and the cat ran so fast, like that's the biggest sparrow I've ever seen.
Actually, my cat, even though she's only indoors, when she's sitting on the windowsill, and if a crow flies over, she ducks. So they have good instincts about what could lift them and carry them off.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, I don't let out my cats anymore at all, because I've got coyotes out here and stuff too, and so it's just like they decided it was a bad idea. But my identification question is, I was going down my driveway this morning, and I live kind of like in the middle of nowhere, and I saw these two birds. They seemed like they were a pair, and they looked like killdeer, but smaller, and they had yellow stripes under their wings. Do you know what those might be?
Bill and Noel, what do you think?
I have no idea.
Stripe under the wing.
I mean, you do get some brown in killdeers, and they could have been younger birds, but they're just flushed from the ground as you drove down?
Exactly, and you know how they'll lay their nest right in the middle of your driveway, you know, right. And then you have to keep from running them over and stuff like that. But I've never seen any with the yellow underneath, or any that were that small, and I didn't know if they were like fledglings or if they were like a different type of killdeer, because they got to be in the same family, because they looked really like a killdeer.
All killdeer basically look alike, and the young ones look somewhat like the adults.
The smaller version of them.
Yeah, there's not much variation, so there's no so-called other type of killdeer. There are other close relatives, but they're not as an upland species the way killdeer tend to be. Semi-palmated plovers and some of those close relatives, they tend to be more in the mudflats, a little more habitat specialists, and they're Arctic breeders. We'll see them pass through, but I wouldn't expect them in your driveway. Got a stumped.
All right.
And I don't think your sighting of the crane on a building, too. I don't think I've ever seen a crane perched anywhere except on the ground.
I was wondering if that might not be great blue heron.
And I was wondering, too, if it was a great blue heron, which will, I mean, they nest in trees, they will land on things that stick up in the air, whereas I've never seen a crane anywhere other than on the ground. So
it was really funny. I'm like, that is a huge bird to be on top of the garage.
I mean, turkey vultures will do that. I mean, turkeys will do that. Geese will do that, perch on top of houses or sheds or garages. But Well, I'm just really wondering about a crane perched on a building.
Well, thanks for that call, Susan. And if you get a picture of that killdeer-like bird, go ahead and put it on our Facebook page, and we'll ask Bill and Noel to take a look at it later.
Make it a little easier for us.
There you go. And we are talking birds and bird watching with Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And with you when you call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your Labor Day with us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Larry will be back tomorrow, and he'll be visiting with Peter Green of Infostar.com. Peter will explain what cloud computing is and its potential at work, home, and school. Plus, he'll share this month's top 10 list of useful websites, and of course, he'll answer your computer questions too. That's tomorrow, starting at 11. Bill and Noel, we have several people who want to join in the conversation, so let's go right back to the phone. Joan in Madison is next. Hi, Joan.
Hey, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have something to say about wrens. The lady called. I've had wren houses, but I've taken them down for the main reason that I'm sure your guests know this, that wrens are terribly, territorial. And if you have any nests around in your yard, I've had cardinals build nests, and the wrens have ruined it, the eggs, and chased them away. My daughter lives in the country, and she has bluebird houses where she has wrens. They've ruined their nest and chased the birds away. They're not very good neighbors.
Is that your experience, Bill and Noel?
They definitely will involve, I guess, other species' nests. They will tend to, at times, puncture the eggs in another species' nest. So, yeah, they do have some habits that some people don't appreciate. But again, you know, all these species have essentially evolved and living together. And I think, as far as overall populations, it's not like house wrens are causing any kind of decline or real problem in populations of these other birds. But when you're trying to encourage as many different species in your yard as you can, putting up with house wrens can be a little bit of an issue at times.
Well, I do recall the original caller we had on that. The assumption was that house wren was not native. And I couldn't remember or couldn't place it whether she was thinking house sparrow or English sparrow, as it's also known, or maybe this unfavorable habit of the wren that makes it somewhat undesirable, but it is a native. Probably the biggest rap that they get, I mean, he's a feisty little thing, but when people have just tried to establish bluebird trails and then put house wren boxes or place the bluebird boxes where they're more suitable for a house wren, they will go to the neighboring houses and they'll pip the eggs. And with that, yeah, you know, they get a bad rap for that. But as Noel said, you know, it's all part of nature.
Thanks for that call, Joan. Let's go right to Dennis in Little Rice. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I get up in the morning before 6 when I'm out drinking my coffee on the patio, and I hear what I think is a whippoorwill, but I can't find them in my bird book.
And you live where, Dennis? What part
Little
of the
Rice, Oneida County.
Okay. So northern Wisconsin.
Well, as I mentioned before, it's always a good bird because they are declining. Noel mentioned, too, that they're really hard to see. They're quite secretive and well camouflaged. But when they start vocalizing, you can't miss them. They nest on the ground. They look like dead leaf litter. They're very secretive as far as trying to see them. But this is what really would be the loss, and it has been from so many parts of the state, is that constant sound of that whippoorwill in those late spring and summer evenings. It's something that is disappearing from our woods, and we're not quite sure why whippoorwills are declining. Nice to hear from people like yourself where we do still have populations around, and we're hoping we can keep it that way.
Could one of you do the whippoorwill call for us?
They just call their name. It's it's a whippoorwill.
It's a real fast, just repeated, just on and on.
In a field guide, they should be page-wise, they should be closely to where the owls are pictured and where the chimney swifts are. They're kind of located in a family that's in that location. If you have a field guide that's organized by you know, the more primitive birds in the front, like waterfowl, and end up with the perching birds in the back. So they're going to be more than halfway through your field guide.
It's in a family that we know as both nightjars. They tend to fly at night, and they've got this big gaping mouth for grabbing large flying insects like moths. I actually found an injured one years ago, and for a relatively medium-sized bird, it is amazing how big of a bucket mouth they actually have. The other name they give to that family is goat suckers, which comes from an old myth that they would milk goats, and who knows where that ever came from.
Huh. You mentioned goat sucker earlier, and I had never heard that before.
Yeah, it's an old kind of folk name, generic name given to the family of the nighthawks, whippoorwills, and all their relatives. And I think more recently we refer to them as night jars.
Hmm.
Maybe doesn't raise quite as many eyebrows.
Yeah, you can imagine if we did a survey and called it not a night jar survey, but a goat sucker survey, what kind of reaction we would have gotten.
Might get a whole different bunch of bird watchers out there, though. You never know.
I don't know what I'm looking for, but I'm here.
Wearing garlic to ward off the vampires. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that call, Dennis. And let's go to Sarah in Lodi next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, that was a great whippoorwill. But I'd like to know why the cranes are acting very odd out here this year. I've been here 20 years. We live in a very heavily sandhill crane nested area, and they're a regular part of our life. And this year, for the first time ever, I keep driving in the country and finding them sitting in the middle of the road. And it's in multiple places. It's happened between Roxbury and Sauk. It's happened between between the ferry and Lodi on back roads, and between the ferry and Devil's Lake. And I've almost hit them a few times, and it tends to be like maybe two or three birds. And the one in the road near between Lodi and the lake was one bird. But they're sitting smack in the middle of the road, just sitting there.
That's interesting.
I've never seen that.
I have seen cranes in the road and in the ditch sides and walking across roads, but I don't think I've noticed, you know, one year is any different than any other year. And I guess I have no explanation to suggest why this year may be different for you.
I think probably we're seeing some of this odd behavior just because there are more cranes out there. I've noticed in the last 5-plus years actually seeing occasional roadkill cranes.
Right, I have too.
Even turkeys and turkey vultures. Just because the numbers are up, I think just the odds are that we're starting to see some of these more unusual occurrences. And, you know, with some of these cranes, they're also getting pushed into somewhat marginal habitat. They're forced feeding up into some of the upland areas only because all the best places are taken. I remember years ago, someone from the Crex Meadows area, wildlife area way in the northwest, told me that their surveys indicated their cranes had territories of 125 to 300 acres per pair. And I thought that was extraordinary for a pair of birds to commandeer that much land. Thinking back, I think it was just a matter of luxury. There were so few cranes, they could afford to have that much space. I now see them crowding into little wetlands, barely 5 acres in size. And as they're done with nesting, they're moving around into some of these uplands. And I guess they've got to get by the roads or cross the roads periodically, too.
Yeah, I've noticed that, too. When I moved to Wisconsin 34 years ago, there was only one pair of cranes in the Cedarburg Bog in Ozaukee County. And that place is, you know, a few thousand acres in size. The first year, a second pair tried to come in and nest. There was so much conflict between the two, neither pair nested. Now there's dozens of nests in that area, and as Bill mentioned, you can see them in a little cattail marsh that may be just a few acres in size. So they do adapt, and of course that's what makes looking at birds and studying birds see all these changes and how they react to whether it's climate, whether it's reacting to land use changes, prey availability, whatever it may be. It's one of the things that makes looking at birds and studying their behavior such a fascinating exercise.
And I want to point out that Jerry posted on our Facebook page, that's The Larry Mealer Show, and Mealer is M-E-I-L-L-E-R, in case you're having a hard time finding it. He posted a link to Operation Migration, and he said, you may enjoy the crane cam. They also offer an on-site blind for watching the flight training of the cranes. Requests for visiting the blind may be made at their Facebook page. And so he linked to the Operation Migration Facebook page. And for crane fans, of course, Wisconsin is unique in the world because of being able to see all the crane species in one place in, of all places, Baraboo.
Great. The International Crane Foundation, yeah. Right.
Place that everyone should visit sometime over the next Well, whenever you can, but everyone should make that as a destination for you. It should be on your bucket list.
It definitely should.
Visit in Wisconsin.
And we have frequently had folks from the Crane Foundation on the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll certainly have them on again. But it is amazing to be able to see every variety of crane in one place and here in the state. Great. Let's go quickly to Helen in Madison. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for this very interesting program. And I have two questions, if I may. My husband was raised on a farm in northern Minnesota. And, he's 79 years old now. But he saw a lot of meadowlarks in their fields and on the fence posts, but he hasn't seen any at all, even in his travels around either Minnesota or Wisconsin. Wondered what happened or what your opinion is.
That's a very astute observation, because meadowlarks, both eastern and western, which we have used to have plenty of here in Wisconsin, have really declined. Back when the Federal Breeding Bird Survey...
You know what? I'm actually going to have to ask you to hold off there. We need to go into our news break, but we will definitely answer that right afterwards. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your holiday here with us on the Ideas Network. Few things convey a sense of place, of time of day, and of season more than the comings and goings and calls of birds. And this time of year, the activity level reaches a fevered pitch. How closely do you watch the birds that share your habitat? Do you know where to look to see flocks preparing to migrate? Maybe you want to know how to feed those that stay in Wisconsin year-round. Our guests today are Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They're experienced and passionate birders, and they're with us for the next half hour today. They can answer those questions and more when you call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, for updates and fun photos. Like it while you're there to get daily updates on upcoming show topics. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be right back after this look at today's news. So glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller and talking about birds and bird watching with Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Thanks again for joining us today, Bill and Noel.
Oh, always fun.
Absolutely.
And so going back to the question that Helen in Madison had right before the break, noticing a decline in the meadowlark population over the decades, is that something that you two have seen as well?
Absolutely. And then Bill and I could probably talk for hours about grassland birds and how many of them are declining in number, and meadowlarks are kind of almost the top of your thought list when you start talking about grassland birds that are declining. And it's been really significant. You know, 40 years ago, western meadowlarks was one of the 10 most common breeding birds in Wisconsin. Now, I don't even know where to go here in the eastern part of the state to find one. Hmm. And you have to kind of do spatial field trips or spatial excursions to go out to locate a western meadowlark. And eastern hasn't declined quite as much, but it's been a significant, you know, both of these have declined 5 to 10% per year over the last 20 years. And decline, you know, started the 20 years before that. So, yeah, it's an astute observation when you don't see meadowlarks around anymore, since we just think of them as being one of our common breeding birds. But because of changing land use practices and agricultural practices, you know, more and more row crops, more and more early harvesting of alfalfa, less pasturing, especially the pasturing that allowed the vegetation to establish to the height where meadowlarks would nest, is... It's something that's almost bygone now, and we have to depend upon some of these large projects that we're trying to do in the state to encourage grassland birds to return, or encourage crop reserve programs, CRP lands, to be there for these nesting birds. I'm not sure really with the changes and with the economies today, what the future are for some of these grassland birds. It's a real cause for concern.
Well, that's also a reason why we keep watch on so many of these different kinds of birds. Wisconsin, we've got roughly 300 different species of birds we might see in any year. And of that, we've certainly been discussing and celebrating some of the real successes and recoveries of some birds. And some of them, like Kirtland's warblers and whooping crane, have taken a tremendous focused effort. And while there's some great successes, there are others that we have some real serious concerns, and it's kind of a mixed picture, and we're trying to keep them all going.
Share one story about a sandhill crane. My wife emailed me during the break. There was a couple out on Highway 33 here in Ozaukee County recently, and there was a woman actually out trying to herd them off the road and direct traffic around them. So, you know, this phenomenon is happening a lot of different places. And
interesting.
It's, you know, a safety issue, I guess.
Right.
For cranes and people.
Right, yeah, for everyone involved, I'm sure. Let's go now to Liz in Viroqua. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Two things. I have 80 acres in rural Vernon County, and I have a 10-acre hayfield, and I do not allow cutting until after the nesting season is over. The other thing is I have a bluebird house that I put in when I first moved here, and I'm noticing, because of good forest management on my 40 acres of hardwoods, that the bluebirds, one pair will go in the house, and the others will go nest in the snags I have left in the forest behind, the old woodpecker holes. So most of my bluebirds are nesting in the woods the way they did before they were endangered.
Well, and that's the way these birds have always persisted, was basically the mixed landscape, the natural events out there, both young forests growing back again, and the sort of a mosaic of habitats provided a little bit of room and opportunity for everybody. But as people have dominated the landscape, essentially what we have is winners and losers. And I always remind people that these very large, abundant populations, such as Canada geese, our robins, blackbirds, and gulls, they're the result of the same thing as our endangered species. As we change the land, some of them get opportunities they've never had before at the expense of others.
And thank you, Liz, for taking those management practices that really encourage nesting of our native species. So thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Liz. You just mentioned Canada geese, and I definitely want to take time to talk about some waterfowl. On the Facebook page, Jack posted a very interesting picture. It says, I was taking pictures of loons earlier this summer, and noticed a reddish tint on the white feathers of some of them. Someone told me that it was oil residue from last summer's Gulf oil spill. Is this what it is?
Probably not, because you also have the birds going through a molt. There would have been feather replacements, and the chance of that persisting that long on the feathers, first of all, much less the fact that the feathers have been replaced, I would doubt that.
If you go to some place like Crex Meadows up in Grantsburg, northwestern Wisconsin, where loons nest, the water up there can be quite brown in nature. And it, you know, has some flocculin in it, so I'm guessing it's
staining on the feathers.
Staining on the feathers from the kind of water that they're
like, maybe a high mineral content in the water. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting, and certainly a lot less depressing than oil spill residue. So let's hope that's
had they been that exposed to the oil, there would have been a serious problem of the matting of the feathers and loss of insulation, and actually a bird like a loon, if it gets oiled enough, it may actually either drown or die of hypothermia because it doesn't have the insulation. So to have been that exposed and to come all the way up here, he probably wouldn't have made it in the first place.
Great. Well, thanks for answering that, Bill
happier,
and Noel.
Happier.
a little happier reason. Let's keep talking a little bit about waterfowl. Both Canada geese and ducks go through a flightless period that's just ending right about now. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, it's an interesting phenomenon because all birds replace their feathers, usually the wing and tail feathers, once a year, and these things do wear out. So in order to be capable of flying and certainly migration, they have to replace them. And usually body feathers are replaced twice a year, which is why we say, for example, goldfinches being lemon yellow in the summer and that drab color with the heavier under feathers, the down for the winter coat. Most birds will replace the wing feathers one at a time. Ducks and geese, however, these are fast flyers. They need a full complement of feathers, and also opportunities afford them the chance to be able to dump all those feathers at once. And so for about a 2 to 3 week period in mid-late summer, they're flightless. And what happens then is, for the ducks in particular, if you think of the common mallard, the male is brilliant green head, nice bright colors, which is great for attracting a mate in springtime. But if you can't fly, you don't want to be that brightly colored. So they will also shed the body feathers and assume the female plumage. This is what we call the eclipse plumage. So those bright colored males of the ducks by about July, August are looking really drab. They become incredibly secretive. The good news is that, first of all, they don't have to fly in midsummer. The young that the females are rearing aren't able to fly yet anyhow. It's long ways away from migration. And as far as shelter and food, well, they're swimming in it. And so these birds can become flightless and be quite secure. So right now, the birds are gaining the ability to fly again. They've got their feathers back, but especially for the ducks. They're looking very drab and rather battered yet. And over the next month or so, we'll be seeing different birds at different stages of that that molt as they regain those bright spring colors. So wood ducks right now, some of them are starting to show a hint of some nice brilliant plumages. Others are looking kind of battered and scruffy looking. And for both bird watchers and especially for the early waterfowl hunters, can be hard to tell if you've got a drake, mallard, or a hen there. Mm. So they're slowly getting those colors. They will then, about the time that some of the early migrants are departing for these waterfowl, will start to attain that spring color. Others, like shovelers and blue-winged teal, they're gone before they ever are greened up. They will then have the bright colors down south, and they will start to attract the mate on the wintering ground and then bring her back again. Or actually, she brings the male back. He's following her.
Great. Thanks for that. And let's also talk about another group of birds. Let's talk about raptors. Some raptors stay here all winter. Do some migrate?
Yes. We've got some birds that are regular migrants. For example, rough-legged hawks, snowy owls come down from the Arctic. Red-tailed hawks, we've known some of them to stick around while individuals may leave. There was also an interesting study of a banded bird near the Green Bay area. It was a kestrel, one of our little falcons, that one year it stayed, one winter it left. It has a lot to do with food availability. Hmm. Doesn't matter how cold it is, but we have to have a good rodent population. So these little rodents do go through cycles. And with that, when there's plenty of food, everybody moves in or can stay behind. When there isn't, they need to disperse.
And we know that our songbirds go down to Central and South America. Where do our raptors go?
Well, they go different places. We have some that go all the way to the tropics, like our osprey. So they're
broad-winged hawks.
Long-distance migrant, as Bill mentioned. Broad-winged hawks go down into, you know, Panama, even into northern South America. So we have some that are quite long-range migrants, where others are just heading maybe far enough south, as he mentioned, things like kestrels and redtail, which we always have a few around in the wintertime. Others may only migrate a short distance, maybe a couple of states farther south than Wisconsin. So each species has evolved a strategy that makes them the most successful, and this strategy can change, as Bill mentioned, even on an individual from year to year. But now, as we get into the fall period, it's a nice time to be out along some of our great lakes, like the western shore of Lake Michigan, when raptors are migrating during the daytime. I suppose we were talking earlier about all the chip notes at night for our smaller birds. We have a number of species that migrate diurnally, the raptors being one of them. So you can gather along the western shore of Lake Michigan at a few strategic locations, and hopefully on the right kind of wind and weather conditions, preferably west or northwest or north winds, be able to observe some of these movements in good numbers. One of the locations just north of us in the Duluth area, they had a record number of sharp-shinned hawks already moving past their facility on the shore of Lake Superior. These birds will be coming down through Wisconsin in the coming days, in the coming weeks, and hopefully at some of these good locations. We just have a new Hawk Watch platform built at Forest Beach Migratory Preserve in Ozaukee County, and hopefully a few of us will be there on the right days to see some of these movements along the lakeshore, because the birds do not like to move out over Lake Michigan, so they kind of hug the shoreline. Mm. So it's a good place to see some of these birds migrating.
Nancy emailed, "We have lived in our home on the Fox River in De Pere for 15 years. We have heard owls, especially in the early spring, but have only seen a few at dusk, usually diving for rodents, etc. This past spring, we had two owlets in our yard for about 2 weeks. We also saw the adults watching over them. We tried to find the nest, but had no luck. I was wondering why we only saw them for 2 weeks, and will the adults nest in the same area next year?"
They'll typically nest in the same area, as Bill mentioned earlier. If they're successful and the habitat is suitable for them, they'll tend to come back to the same area. These are probably great horned owl, young. They do not build their own nest. They'll take over the nest, typical of a red-tailed hawk, or maybe use the same nest that they used the previous year to nest in, large stick nests in trees. Who knows why they moved out? Maybe the young became more independent. Maybe they found a better prey base someplace else. So these birds are always moving around, trying to take advantage of the opportunities afforded them to find plentiful prey.
And birds that are as secretive as owls, the sightings are so infrequent. Nothing to say that when the young were just out and still begging, making themselves more visible, you saw them for 2 weeks, and as they start to move around a bit, they could have moved anything from, as Noel said, looking for better food some distance, or maybe they only moved 100 yards and just back into a little heavier cover, and you just don't even know it.
And David in Madison emailed, why do I sometimes see smaller blackbirds going after larger hawks? The blackbirds, maybe ravens, are in groups of three or more.
Well, there's always a little battle between some of these species. You will see kingbirds and blackbirds chasing off crows and red-tailed hawks. Now, they don't like them nearby because they are a potential predator on the nests and young. And you also see a little bit of battle going on where the crows, they hate the big owls, and they will mob them, they will scream, and it's a great way to find owls is the crows will find them for you. On the other hand, then at nighttime when the crows go to roost, the owls go out and they'll hunt for them. So, yeah, I'd keep them at bay, too, if you could end up at dinner in the evening time. So, yeah, you'll have got birds. That's basically for protection, trying to keep others at prey and at bay. And whether they are a serious predator or just look like it, why take a chance?
Yeah, as Bill mentioned, this behavior is called mobbing, and it's an anti-predator behavior when, you know, individuals, as Bill mentioned, blackbirds or kingbirds will gather together and maybe cooperatively attract or try to harass it out of the neighborhood.
And I've had a number of people who told me that they have never seen an owl in the wild. And, yeah, even the big great horns, they can be quite secretive and blend in well. But as I said just before, the easiest way to find them is when you hear that mobbing call, this screeching and calling, walk over there, and they'll be oftentimes within just a few feet and just screaming at these big owls trying to keep them at bay. And it's the easiest way to find them and get a good view of them.
Well, I'm hoping that our discussion today is getting people excited about bird watching. Maybe experienced bird watchers don't need any encouragement, but maybe there are some novices out there. And I have to say, I definitely fall more on the novice end of the spectrum. If people have a suggestion of great places to bird watch, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us your, maybe not specifically your favorite spots, because I know people might be a little protective, but in general, great places to watch for birds. And Kat posted on the Facebook page, a friend and I want to get involved with birding in Washington or Waukesha or in Ozaukee counties. Can you give us specific contact info and advice on where to start? Are there any events in Horicon with guided migration education or watching?
I believe my email, I'll let Bill answer okay. Horicon, but I believe my email address is on your website, Judith. And I have a bird club that operates out of the River Edge Nature Center. There are other bird clubs, audubon societies in the Waukesha, Washington, Ozaukee area, and there are field trips, meetings, opportunities to become involved. So, you know, email me and I'll try to respond to that, and I'm sure Bill can help out with Horicon.
Well, I would suggest for Waukesha County, there's also nature centers, Retzer Nature Center,
right.
The Southern Kettle Moraine, Schlitz Audubon. These are places where they've got their spring and fall field trips where you'll have an experienced guide and others coming out to help you. Jump in on that. And for Horicon Marsh, funny you should ask, because we're going to be starting our fall naturalist programs. And if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources website, type in Horicon Marsh, and you'll see under the education programs, all of our weekend programs are there, a number of them focusing on birds. I'll be leading those. Glad to take you out and get you started. And as Noel said, you know, bird clubs are out there. We do have one at Horicon Marsh. Throughout the state, there's a number of them. The Wisconsin Society for Ornithology leads field trips around the state. Go out with the experienced people. Best thing to do. So some of these nature centers, wildlife areas, places like that, you can join in with others, and it's a great way to get started.
And there is a link directly to the Horicon Marsh Wildlife Area site on the DNR site from our Facebook page. So people can go directly there. And I'm thinking of making my way over to Horicon this week. What might I see there, Bill?
Well, as I mentioned last night, things really changed. So some of the summer birds, well, it only means that some things left, but other things are coming in. It looked like duck numbers are building, and it looked like quite a few green-winged teal came in overnight. The pelicans are bunching up right now. Most of those are still remaining. For the songbirds, things are changing quickly. As Noel indicated earlier, they're pretty reclusive among the dense leaf cover yet. But take a close look. You might be able to see some of the mixed flocks moving through. And out on the open marsh, easier to see. The ducks, the grebes, the other water birds. I saw some trumpeter swans this morning up on the north end. You just never know what you're going to find, and I think that's kind of the fun of it, too. Get out to good areas where you know there's usually a good mix of wildlife. And with that, see what are the common expected characters that you should find out there, and always the surprises.
Yeah, Bill mentioned the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. They have two field trips this month that's open to everyone. A week from Sunday, September 11th, there will be a trip to the Bay Beach Wildlife Sanctuary in Green Bay, focusing especially on warblers, and then a weekend event, September 23rd, 24th, 25th, up in Duluth Superior, actually in Superior at Wisconsin Point, the so-called Jaegerfest, which is one of the best times of year to see a group of birds that we very seldom see here in Wisconsin, Jaegers. But they also look at gulls and shorebirds and raptors and whatever else happens to be around. So there's a lot of opportunities around various locations in the state for birding.
Great. Let's go back to the phones and talk to Peggy in Milwaukee next. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, guys. I'm calling from the east side of Milwaukee to tell you about our resident female wild turkey.
Aha. Uh-huh.
She's been hanging around the east side here for all summer. And my question to you is she going to continue to hang around, or do you think that she'll leave when the weather gets cold?
Well, I think it's just a chance opportunity that the birds showed up there. Again, here's a turkey population that's been increasing over the years, and the more that are out there, the better chance that somebody's just going to kind of break the mold and show up in odd areas. If there is sufficient cover and food, the bird can certainly stick around. Probably a little bit limited for the bird, especially for year-round needs. So hard to say if it'll stay for a while and feels comfortable enough and can maintain itself, or whether it's got a little bit out of the normal range and eventually decides to move on a little bit.
And there is a resident flock of the northeastern part of the county in Schlitz-Audubon Nature Center along that wooded ravines there along the lake. There is a resident turkey flock, so maybe she wandered down and got separated from that flock somehow.
Well, and Peggy, thanks for that call, because I think that's a good reminder that you don't necessarily have to go, you know, trudging out into the middle of nowhere to see wildlife. You might have to be a little more attentive in urban areas, but there are certainly creatures out there to be seen.
The Milwaukee Lakeshore is fantastic with all the county parks in Milwaukee County. And being along the lakeshore to attract a lot of migrants coming in off the lake during the daytime, I mean, you can just see wonderful things in Milwaukee's parks.
And a follow-up to that, there was a caller who said, what's going on with Wisconsin's pheasant and turkey populations? It seems that pheasants aren't around in big numbers, while, as you guys were just saying, the turkey population seems to have exploded.
Yeah, pheasants have been having a tough time. First of all, pheasants are not native to North America. They actually come from China. They were brought over around the turn of the century, and they were introduced as a hunting bird, and they did fairly well, actually, during the early to mid part of the 20th century, and that was because of the agricultural mosaic at that time. So the birds took off quite well when average field size was only 25 to 40 acres. We had pasturing, we had fence rows, fallowed crops, rotated crops, and in those smaller field size and in that kind of a mixed mosaic, the pheasants did extremely well. However, as agricultural practices have changed, it's just not the kind of mosaic they need. And also, it's the loss of the small wetlands within that agricultural mosaic. That was important wintering sites for them to be able to survive Wisconsin's winter. So, yeah, pheasants are down, turkeys are up.
And do they tend to be in, is it an inversely proportional relationship, or
no,
could they
no both relationship.
Be?
Okay. Turkeys are more or less a forest bird. Pheasants are out on the grassland brush edge. And so, no, there's no direct relationship to them. But, you know, as lands change, we found opportunities for turkeys, but they're declining for pheasants in other places.
Well, amazingly, we're just about at the end. Thanks so much again for joining us, Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright.
Goes well, quickly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Thanks so much.
Yeah, we're just getting warmed up, too.
And thanks for listening to us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.